Hello, it's Miss Strachan and
Miss Burkett.
And today we're going to talk to you about Ozymandias and London. So I'll start with Ozymandias. I think it's an interesting sonnet. As you know, a sonnet is 14 lines, and that is the amount of lines that we have in Ozymandias. But it's not really a love poem.
Definitely not, no.
Which is interesting, because normally the sonnet form is
linked to poetry.
Linked to love poems.
But we could link to the fact that he was a romantic poet.
Yeah, that's nice.
So, although he wasn't, romantic poetry wasn't always about love, maybe because he was writing about that, or he was of that generation, he may have just wanted to write in that form. Maybe that's what he was more used to.
Yeah, perhaps. And also, although he, in the poem, he talks with scorn about Ozymandias. Ozymandias was quite a powerful figure. It was linked to the pharaoh Ramoses, and that's who he's writing about. The statue in Ozymandias is of the pharaoh Ramoses, and actually he was looked up to and loved by, yeah, and admired by the common people.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's where the inspiration is for the sonnet form as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Again, so maybe that could be represented the love that his followers had for the pharaoh.
Yeah, exactly.
And why they built that ginormous statue that's now in ruins.
Yeah, exactly. That's a lovely point. And I think it's interesting, isn't it, that the name Ozymandias is just one single name. So the title of the poem is the name Ozymandias. So it's almost arrogantly assuming that we will know who that is.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, well, I like that because actually immediately you're drawn into the fact that this character is cold and supercilious. He believes he's superior to other people.
Yeah, arrogant, isn't he?
Yeah, he is really arrogant. And I think...
Yeah, sorry. I was going to link that to when he says about the bit that's inscribed on the pedestal of the statue that says, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair."
Yeah.
Almost like people just had to look up to him and they could do nothing but despair because they could never have his achievements.
Yeah, exactly.
And ye mighty could even refer to God.
Yeah.
We discussed that.
Yeah, exactly. So he could be comparing himself to a godlike creature, mm-hmm. you know, even God can't compare to me, mm-hmm. which is completely arrogant. And it's interesting, isn't it, the way that that line uses caesura to break up ye mighty and despair. And I think that caesura and the commas within that line really do emphasise that he thinks he is better than everyone else.
Absolutely, yeah. Very powerful. What else has he thinks is better?
Sneer of cold command?
Cold's quite an interesting word there, isn't it?
Yeah.
It didn't rule with kind of compassion and love. It just told people or ordered people what to do and they just had to follow it.
Yeah, exactly. And a sneer, that's that kind of real smirking, sarcastic expression on your face. And it's
linked to the frown as well.
Yeah.
It's kind of almost that idea that he just looks down upon everyone else.
Yeah, so you could almost say it's a lexical set, couldn't you? Linking to the statue's appearance, but the statue is also meant to be a really good likeness of
the man himself.
So therefore he doesn't sound particularly nice,
and he mocked them as well later on, the hand that mocked them.
Yeah, he does. He's not particularly
giving or generous, is he?
No. He expects everything coming to him, mm-hmm. but he doesn't expect to be able to give anything out.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting as well, the way that nature is presented in this poem. So we've got the idea of conflict and we've got the idea of nature. Ozymandias, the statue, presents that kind of idea of conflict because he is this overpowering and powerful leader, and then you've got the idea of nature taking over when he's dead and actually just destroying what he tried to create. So nature is actually more powerful than Ozymandias himself. How would that link to the context?
Oh, so we can link that to the fact that his wife committed suicide. We were saying, weren't we? And how she was kind of quickly replaced by another woman and kind of forgotten about and replaced very quickly. We could, I guess, link that to the fact that once Ozymandias, or the pharaoh, had died, he was very quickly kind of forgotten about and replaced by someone else. Even the statue kind of disintegrated and was destroyed amongst the desert, the vast desert.
Yeah, exactly. So the desert overtakes him. And that's a really nice link. And I think as well that Shelley is suggesting that man is not all powerful. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, man is just man. Nature will outlast you, mm-hmm. and God is more powerful than you. Whether you believe or not in God is a different question, because mm-hmm. it was doubtful whether he was a true believer. But the idea of destruction is shown in the two vast and trunkless legs of stone. So you can see, and the half sunk, a shattered visage lies. So you can see that destruction, and those noun phrases emphasize how the statue has actually broken up and is now kind of face down in the...
Almost unrecognisable for the leader he once was, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the comparison at the end with the decay of that colossal wreck. Really gives that sense that it's just almost disintegrated into nothing, almost completely forgotten. And then compared with the lone and level sands that stretch far away, it's that idea that nature is continuous, and nature will always come back, and it will always be level, and it will always exist and kind of scrub out anything, any other things that have come before it.
Yeah, any sense? Marks
like
on the land.
Almost covered completely by the sand.
Yeah, yeah. So we, as people, need to be careful about how we present ourselves and how we present our desire for power, because the Pharaoh Ramses was well known to be quite powerful and quite power hungry. And Shelley is perhaps saying that if that is something that we look for as people, then it is only going to lead to destruction mm-hmm. and decay and unhappiness, because he certainly doesn't seem to be particularly happy in this poem. And I think it links really nicely to London.
I agree, miss, it does.
Yeah, and William Blake was also a romantic poet. And remember, we don't mean romantic as in, oh, here goes a nice rose for you or a box of chocolates. We do mean romantic in the sense that they were fighting against the Enlightenment period, where everything was scientific, and they're trying to show us that nature and beauty and mm-hmm. looking outside of one's own mind and seeing the beauty in life is more important.
I'm just admiring your words there, miss, sorry.
That's
So, London, again, another romantic poet, like miss has just said. And also, there's that idea of conflict between, like, power and those without power. So, as we can assume Blake, but as the character, as the persona is walking through London, he's noticing all this evidence of woe. He talks about marks of weakness and marks of woe. And it's quite hyperbolic. Every cry of every man, and every infant's voice, it's the idea that everyone in London is suffering in some way because of the people who have power and are not using that
power wisely.
Power wisely, yes.
Yeah, and I really like the use of repetition there, because it's not saying that it's just you and I that are struggling. It's saying that no matter what stage of life you're in, at that point there will be somebody struggling. So mm-hmm. every man, so collective people as a collective, every infant, so every child, and it's a cry of fear mm-hmm. in every voice, in every ban. It's emphasizing that we all struggle and that we are all human and we're all in it together.
And it's also the idea that struggle will continue unless someone kind of steps in and helps out. So when it talks about the idea of fear, for me, is not just fearing what's happening at the moment and maybe struggling, or the Industrial Revolution, if we link it to context, but actually fearing what will happen in the future when there's that kind of level of uncertainty. And I think the bit towards the end, if I jump ahead, is that okay?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
When they talk about the newborn infant's tear and how the harlot is cursing them, that kind of breakdown of marriage, again, that kind of suggests that that's going to be a cycle that's repeated and repeated, that people are living these terrible lives and full of sadness and dismay unless something important happens or something changes.
Or changes, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that links, I think the last line links really nicely to the first line, actually, because you get the first person pronoun, I, and you've got wander through each chartered street. And it's this idea that Blake is himself walking through the streets of London and looking at people and observing. So he's not actually in the moment himself. He's watching other people, and he's the chartered streets, you know, refer to the kind of the way that, or I read it, that it's the way that London is suddenly becoming this massively populated place, whereas before it was probably slightly smaller. And, you know, it's linked to the way that the Industrial Revolution has moved people from rural areas into the towns. And you're seeing the kind of poverty and the suffering and the,
as a result.
Yeah, and the difficulty that it causes. And things like children working. You know, he talks about children. He talks about infants.
Chimney sweepers as well, that would have typically been children, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's kind of, child labour was a huge problem at that time. And it seems to me that Blake is reflecting on this as a problem that man needs to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the reference to the in the third stanza about how the chimney sweepers are kind of cleaning the church chimneys, and they're working for the church, and there's soldiers dying and blood running down the palace walls. He's really pointing the finger there, isn't he?
Yeah.
The church isn't doing enough to help this time, and kind of the palace walls, it's almost like the country's almost given up entirely on their people. And soldiers are dying, and we were talking about how that's quite helpless. They're just almost accepting this terrible fate that they have.
Yeah, and hapless yeah. soldier sigh. You know, that assonant, sorry, sibilance within the
it's lovely, yeah.
yeah, it's really lovely. And it's such a shame, because you can't imagine, you imagine soldiers as being brave and strong and fearsome, but yet Blake is portraying them as slightly weak and unable to do anything. And perhaps, you know, hapless is the idea that they don't really know what to do, so they're in a position like everyone else, even though they're supposed to be brave and strong. So it's interesting.
Very interesting. And that would link quite nicely to the Ozymandias again, actually, wouldn't it? The
yeah.
idea that they're supposed to be this powerful, brave figure to look up to, I guess, but
they've used that power and destroyed it.
Yeah.
Or had that power destroyed by
something else.
Yeah, some outside force. Mm. Yeah. And it is interesting that there is a sense of destruction in London. A destruction of family life, a destruction of charity. You know, the churches are supposed to help people, yet here they are actually using children for labour.
Yeah.
And then you've got the sense of destruction in Ozymandias with the, you know, arrogant ruler towering over everyone else and,
yeah.
you know, making other people create this vast stone to present an image of them to the rest of the world. And we've got the sense that, you know, man isn't in control of their own destiny from both of the poems, and I think that's quite a nice...
a really nice link.
Yeah.
I also like how they're both talking about a journey they've been on, or they've met someone on a journey who has seen these things. It makes it a bit more, for me anyway, a bit more powerful that it's, we can assume a personal or a semi-personal experience. So I wander through, or I met a traveller who comes back and feeds these stories. It's from a similar perspective, isn't it? Commenting on what they see around them.
Yeah.
Observational poetry.
Yeah, and it's nice, isn't it? It's nice. The structure is really different as well, because although Ozymandias is a sonnet, London isn't. You've got the kind of very even four-line, yeah, alternate rhyme. Street meet, flow woe, man ban, fear here, and that almost that kind of alternate rhyme can create a sense that this is
a
never-ending cycle. Yeah.
yeah. Exactly, which would link again, we talked about the cycle idea, didn't we, in the other poem?
Yeah.
About how eventually nature comes back and takes over.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that's, both poems really do link to the idea that man is not as powerful as maybe he thinks he is, and perhaps Blake and Shelley were quite similar in that respect, because they both wanted us to understand through their words and through their, you know, little stories that they tell us in their poems, that you know, we are not as powerful as we think we are. And,
yeah.
you know, perhaps we need to stand back and take a look at what's happening either in our own lives or wider society.
Because
they're not both talking just about their own perspective on things. They're talking about the wider perspective as well, aren't they?
Wider issues, yeah.
Yeah. So it's quite nice.
It's a lovely pairing.
It is. And I don't think we can probably see very much else, can we, miss?
I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's it for now.
Thanks, guys. We hope you've enjoyed.
Bye.
Bye.